Okay, I get to introduce tonight's speaker, and it is Denise from San Diego.
I'm probably good. I think I'm good. My name's Denise, and I am an alcoholic.
Nice.
By the time I got to AA, the only thing that I had left was desperation. It was all I needed. My sobriety date's October 14th, 1997, and my home group is Woman's Gut Level. We meet on Sunday mornings at 10 a.m. at the Grape Street Alano Club. I come from a long line of champion alcoholics. My mom was Scottish and my dad was Irish, and here I am, a speaker at an AA meeting. Go figure, right? Growing up, I had everything, you know, we had everything we needed and most things we wanted. When I was in the second grade, they thought I had a speech impediment. And so they sent me to speech therapy class. And you know how mean second graders can be, right? So a couple of times a week, Tuesdays and Thursdays, about 20 minutes before the class ended, anyone who had to go to speech therapy had to gather up their books and head down to the speech therapy office. And all of the kids would make fun of us, have fun in speech therapy, you know. And down there in speech therapy, they were teaching us how to properly pronounce our consonants and the proper shape of our mouth to make a vowel sound. And the way that they tracked our progress was, this was back in the day of blackboards, where with chalk, we had drawn little thermometers on the blackboard. And as our vowel sounds were getting hotter, we got to fill in the thermometers with a red colored chalk. And as the weeks went on, I noticed that everybody else's thermometers were getting pretty filled up there. And mine was just staying kind of lukewarm. So after a few more weeks of this, the therapist decided that she was gonna call my mom to see why I wasn't making any progress. And my mom answered the phone and said, "What the bloody hell do you mean? She isn't making any progress." Yeah. I didn't have a speech impediment. I just had my mother's Scottish accent. Yeah. But you know, I left that experience with a feeling that I needed to do more than anybody else just to feel equal to them. And that's a belief that still haunts me just a little bit today. Growing up, my mom had a lot of parties in the backyard, little barbecues. She would have the neighborhood wives over, and wine spritzers were the drink of the day. Now, this was way before White Claw. This was before even Bartles and James. This was back in the day where you had to make your own wine spritzer. So they'd put a little bit of 7-Up in a cup with some wine. And it wasn't red wine to go with the beef and white wine to go with the chicken. They were buying whatever was on sale. And usually the thing that was on sale was those big gallon green jugs of Gallo wine, right? They had the Rhine wine and they had a nice rosé. And being the little people pleaser that I was, I would always help to kind of refill everybody's glasses, even at this young age. And of course, I was back there refilling their cups, but taking sips. And the booze always made me feel like I could just run a little faster and jump a little higher, you know? As I got further into elementary school, we started experimenting with things. You know how it goes. You steal the cigarettes from your parents and try them out. None of my other friends' parents smoked, and my mom smoked Pall Mall non-filters. So all of us, our first cigarettes were Pall Mall. You had to pick the tobacco right off your tongue with those things. It was terrible. I'm surprised I ever became a smoker following that experience. But we also started stealing booze. You know, I grew up in Claremont in a housing complex that was built in the 60s. And so wet bars were very popular there. So every home had a wet bar with liquor cabinets, and it just seemed wrong to not keep them stocked. And so when we were in elementary school, we'd go in there with our little Ziploc baggie and we'd pour a little bit of vodka and a little bit of creme de menthe and a little bit of whatever else we could find. And then if the pour got to be too strong, we would just fill the bottle back up with water so that they wouldn't notice. Same childhood games that everybody does at that age. And, you know, even from then, we weren't drinking for the taste. We were drinking purely for the effect. As I got into high school, we started dabbling with some other things, but I began to, you know, some outside issues, but I began to notice that I seemed to drink a little bit differently than my friends. Now, I didn't think I had a problem. I thought they had a problem. I was always doing the beer math. If there were 9 people there and there was only a 6-pack left, Houston, we have a problem. So I thought they should have been very grateful to always have me around. They seemed to be happy to drink and catch a buzz, and I was always making sure that we were not going to run out. Shortly after high school, I had quite a bit of success. Went to dental assisting school, bought a brand new car right off the lot, was dating a great guy, but slowly but surely the drinking started increasing, the partying started increasing, and I was just drinking things away faster than I could acquire them. And in my early 20s, it got to a point, I was about 23 years old, and the boyfriend had just kicked me out. We packed all the stuff in my car, and I had headed back to the place where the booze was flowing, you know. And the car got stolen that night, and it was the very first time in my life where I had actually lost everything. And it really hurt. Now, I'll tell you, I got pretty good at losing everything as the years progressed, but that night, man, that was a tough night. Gratefully, the owner of the business where we were partying at felt a little bit responsible that my car had been stolen there, and so he decided to get me a rental car. Now, these days, we have Hertz and we have Enterprise, but back in the day, there was actually a rental car company called Rent-A-Wreck. Yeah. Yeah, some of you are shaking, you remember. So you could actually rent a car that was already dented, that already had duct tape on the rear view mirrors. And so here I am, 23 years old, in my Rent-A-Wreck, heading back to my mom's house with my tail just tucked in between my legs. But my mom knew who was coming home. She knew which daughter was coming home. So she had taken the time to put locks on all of the liquor cabinets before I got there. I had landed a pretty prestigious dental assisting job at this time. It was with a surgeon. I think the only reason that he hired me was because he recognized my last name. We had grown up on the same street in Claremont together, and his younger brother was friends with my older brother, and I really think that that's probably the only reason I got the job. But around this time, I was really struggling to get to work on time. Didn't have anything to do with the Rent-A-Wreck, but the problem was that while I was getting ready for work every morning, I'd have to go down the stairs, take a bobby pin out my hair, and pick that lock on the liquor cabinet. And I'd pour about this much vodka, and I'd pour about this much orange juice. I was worried my mom was gonna notice that the orange juice was missing and was gonna get snooping into the liquor cabinet. And I'd shoot that vodka back and back it with the OJ and go back upstairs, and within about 5 minutes, you know, I'd need another drink, and I'd head back down the stairs to pick that lock again and pour a little bit more booze. Long gone were those childhood games of just putting the water back in the bottle. I needed to know exactly how much booze I was getting in those mornings before going to work. So I'm at work one day, and the boss calls me in, and he says, you know, this is your writing in a chart yesterday. And this is your writing in a chart today, and I think you're drunk. And I can't have you here. He was putting people under and everything. And he goes, so I'm going to have to fire you. And I remember thinking, oh, whatever. I was getting to this point where the job was taking up a lot of the party time anyway, you know. And then he says to me, and I think you're too drunk to drive, so I've called your mother. Yeah, he called my mother. So that was not a fun ride home. Now, in the book, it talks about how sometimes there's moderate drinkers and sometimes there's heavy drinkers. And faced with a health crisis or a relationship that breaks up or losing a job, they're able to put the plug in the jug. But what of that of the chronic alcoholic, you know? And so as I was analyzing this situation, my best thinking told me that the problem was my mom. Too many people were calling her. She was putting the locks on the liquor cabinet. I needed to get the heck out of there. And so I hit the rowdy road, and I ended up on the mean streets of downtown San Diego. And I met a whole group of people who had hit rock bottom. And we just set up camp. And for the next 7 years, I lived in the bushes and under bridges and in abandoned buildings. And we were just ripping and running. Catch me if you can, you know? I was a busy, busy alcoholic running around on a bright red stolen mountain bike all over town. The only time I ever even left that 16 by 16 block radius was when I was in the back of a cop car. I can remember one morning I was living in this bush. It was about halfway between downtown and Old Town, right across the street from the Mission Brewery. And you know what they say about real estate, right? Location, 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 right? So this particular bush was right down the street from the recycling center, which is a big place of commerce for the homeless people. The other nice thing was that right across the street from this bush, there was a payphone. And not just any payphone, but a payphone that gets calls back. And I see I'm speaking to the right audience here. You guys remember the magic when you had a pager of finding a payphone that actually had its phone number printed inside it, and you could page someone and give them that number, and that payphone would get calls back. And I tell you, it was just across the street from my bush, so it was just as good as having a landline right in the bush I was living in. But the nicest thing about living in this bush was that across the street in the Mission Brewery, they had these public restrooms that you could access really easily. You could go in through the business park and you could get cleaned up and it wasn't a big deal. But on the weekends, those public doors were closed. And I woke up one Sunday morning needing to use the restroom. And I'll tell you, that saying about not pooping in your own backyard takes on a literal meaning when you're homeless. So I had my eyes on the business that I was going to go through. I'd picked all of the twigs out of my hair and tried to get the dirt off of my clothes so I would look like a member of the public. And I had my eye on this bus touring company, and I was going to weave my way through there to make my way to the bathroom. And as I was approaching the door, I could see the woman inside. They were sitting behind a desk. They looked beautiful like Joyce. They'd showered. They had makeup on. They were ready for the day. And as I got closer to the door, I heard one of them say to the other one, "Hey, look, there's that crazy bush woman." There's that crazy bush woman. Well, it was too late. I was already heading in. And as I headed into the business, you should have seen the look of fear in their eyes, you know? And that wasn't lost on me either. Prior to that day, I didn't really feel like a crazy bush woman. But after that moment, it was really hard to shake. Who can possibly fix that but God? So I'm out there on the streets just ripping and running, and the cops knew me, I knew them. I can remember being stopped one time by this cop. And I was so mad. I'm like, "Larry, what'd you stop me for, you know?" And he goes, "Denise, I didn't stop you. You stopped me." And I'm like, "Ah, oh, shit, you know? What is that supposed to mean?" He goes, "I've been on shift for about an hour and a half, and you have zipped past me on a mountain bike that I can't even afford 8 times. I just wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't stop you." So they're stopping me a lot. Court cases are adding up. And now I'm appearing in front of the judge. And the judge is saying things to me like, "Miss Hanley, you can do 30 days in jail or 30 days in a recovery home. Miss Hanley, You can do 90 days in jail or 90 days in a recovery home. Ms. Hamley, you can do 180 days in jail or 180 days in a recovery home. And the truth is, I always picked the jail time because I figured, well, at least I'll know somebody there. But it got to the point where I was looking at 9 years in prison, you know? And I had never heard of them keeping anyone in a recovery home for 9 years. So I thought, this might be the time to cash in this ticket. So off I go, court ordered, to this woman's recovery home over in Shelltown, you know? And I could hear the laughter and the happy talk as I was approaching the door, and I could hear the woman sharing about their day, and they were talking about next week. They were making plans for their future, you know? And do you know what these women were doing? They were living. And I am surprised that I even recognized it, because I had been dying for so long. But I found a sponsor who took me through the book. And as we went through the book, we encountered those steps. And having had a spiritual awakening, I haven't had to have a drink or a drug since. We hear a lot from the podium about the importance of hitting a bottom. And I've heard it shared that a bottom isn't something that happens to you. It's not that you got the DUI or you were living in the bushes or the kids got taken away or your mom didn't love you right or your dad died too soon. But rather, a bottom is something that happens within you. It's a breaking of the spirit. And it's only from that place of brokenness that the healing can begin. So get cracked if you ain't. I was in the recovery home, and I'm hearing all of these women sharing about the big book and the steps and the traditions, and they were even talking about relapse prevention, and I didn't even have 30 days, and I was saying to them, man, where do you guys learn about all of this stuff? Like, it was all completely foreign to me. I knew nothing about it. And one of them said, oh, I went through the VOA's 10-day program. So here in San Diego, we used to have Volunteers of America, they had a detox that you could go to, and then they had this 10-day program that just taught you all about recovery. So I went to the house mom, and I said, hey, I'd like to go to 10-day. And she's like, well, usually it's the other way around. You do detox, then the 10-day, and then you end up here, but okay. I'll hold on to your bed, no worries, while you head down there. I had no idea that this was basically a voluntary commitment to an asylum. It was a lockdown facility. But I got there and I got to learn about all of the ins and outs of how the program and the fellowship works. And on about the third day, you know, down there at 10-day, so it was a lockdown facility, but there was like a little yard, like a little asphalt area that was enclosed with a chain link fence. And they'd let you out like every hour to smoke, and you'd get these breaks in between these classes that you would take. So on about the third day of being in there, we had a class on the third step. And at the end of this class, the facilitator had us all hold hands, and we read the we version of the third step prayer. God, we offer ourselves to thee, you know? And I gotta tell you, we were all holding hands there, and the power in that moment, saying that prayer with all of these like-minded people who had just had enough, I mean, the power in that room, it was better than any drink or drug that I've ever taken. It was just amazing. And when we finished the prayer, we walked out of the room, and I turned down the hallway and ran smack dab into my connect. Now, let me tell you what he was doing there. He'd been in a little bit of trouble on the streets, and I'd been running dope for him for years, but he'd gotten in a little trouble out there on the streets, so he just ducked into 10-day just to get the heat off of him. And he knew that I'd been court ordered to a recovery home, you know, but he didn't know how it was going. And And he said to me, as I saw him right there in the hall, he said, "Hey, it's so good to see you, you know?" He goes, "Hey, don't worry. We're in business. We got it all set up. I got the dope in a can attached to the first pole on the chain link fence, and the money's going on the third pole. We're all set." Talk about we stood at the turning point, you know? And I realized in that moment that I belonged to a new we now. And so he was a little bit surprised when I told him that. And I said, "Hey, I can't help you. You know what I mean? I'm really doing this thing. I'm really going to get sober," I said. "But I'll make sure, like, no one rats you out and no one snitches you off." I was new. You know, that was the best I could do. I know I should have been like, "This is a safe place for recovery in the dope meal." I wasn't there. So the best I could do was like, "Hey, I'll watch out for you just a little bit." And I hear people say, "Gosh, why did God put my connection right there? Why did God put that old boyfriend right there? Why did," you know, and I don't believe that God does these things to us. I believe that God is doing these things for us. That was an opportunity for me in that moment to be rocketed into the fourth dimension. Next, we launched, right? You know, you'll hear the old timers talk about if you've got three frogs on a log and they've made a decision to jump into the river, how many frogs are still on the log? Three, because you haven't taken the action yet. And I'd made that decision to turn my will and my life over, and I was immediately given an opportunity to take some action. And I am just so grateful for that today. We were heading back. I had a few years of sobriety and, you know, successfully transitioned out of that recovery home, and fast forward quite a few years, and my boyfriend and I are heading back from an off-road race that we'd been at. And I got a text message from someone in the program saying, "Hey," she knew I was a dental hygienist, and she knew that I had been teaching dental hygiene. And she said, "Hey, I just went to the dentist, and the dental assistant was so adorable, and she's super excited to go to dental hygiene school, and are you willing to talk to her since you teach at the school?" Well, what my friend didn't realize was I had just quit that job. And I was not very happy about the things that had transpired that led to me just kind of throwing in the towel and quitting. And so I said to my boyfriend, I go, she wants me to reach out to this person about the dental hygiene program, and I don't even work there anymore, you know, and I'm getting kind of pissy about it. And he reminded me that, you know, anytime, anywhere that anybody needs help, we hope that the hand of AA is there to help them, right? And so, you know, so I agree, okay. Yeah. So I text her back and I say, "Yeah, that's fine, you know, send me your number." And when she sent me her number, I thought, "Oh, well, that's kind of an unusual name." The girl's name was Daisy, and I thought, man, that's an unusual name, and I haven't heard that name in a long time. And in fact, the last time that I had heard of anyone being named Daisy, it was this old drug dealer on the streets from all these years before had a little girl and named her Daisy. And I just thought to myself, as we often do throughout our week, oh, well, that would be weird if this was that person. You know what I mean? And a lot of times we don't take any follow-up action. You know, how many times have you thought, "Oh gosh, is that my old friend?" But you just don't say anything. So I made a commitment right there. I said, "Well, I'm going to talk to her, and if she's of the right age, I'm going to find out if this is so-and-so's daughter." And so it took us a couple weeks to finally connect. And oh, we had a great conversation about how she wants to become a dental hygienist. And we talked for about an hour and a half or so. And she was of the right age, and the conversation was going well. And now the conversation's winding down, and it's like the do or die time, right? And so I said to her, I go, "This might sound kind of strange, but is your dad's name so-and-so, you know?" Dead silence. Okay, this is awkward. I knew it would be weird. Another beat of dead silence. And then she says, "How do you know my dad? How do you know my dad?" And I thought, oh, shoot, how do I know her dad now? What do I tell her? I used to run dope for him. So I kind of artfully got around that. And she proceeded to tell me that her mom had gotten sober, but that her dad had been in prison for most of the time that she was growing up. And in fact, they had tried to hide that from her for many years. But at a certain age, you know, all those prison shows became popular. And she's seeing pictures of her dad, and then she's seeing all these prison shows. They're all wearing the same thing. And so she finally, you know, at 8 years old, was like, "Is my dad in prison?" And they finally came clean with her. But it was so interesting because she was able to tell me that she hadn't really had anyone to talk to about this kind of stuff. You know, she was a dental assistant, she was being successful, and she thought people wouldn't understand. And she really appreciated the fact that she could speak with me, someone who kind of knew this whole history. And she told me that he was gonna be getting out after 15 years in the next month or two. And I was really able to help her a lot with this new transition that was gonna be occurring. But on that day, I got to be a bridge for her from the place that we were to where we wanted to be. But more importantly, because I'm a little dense sometimes, is, and I've helped a lot of people through the steps and seen these wonderful journeys for a lot of people, but it took someone from the same block wanting the absolute same career for me to recognize that I had also made that journey. You know, sometimes we're so busy trudging that road that we forget to look back and really admire how far we've come. And because some crotchety old timer reminded me to stick my hand out, I was able to see that view of the pathway that I had taken. And I found that that's really what happens around here when you take the time to show up for others. I've worked the steps a lot, and I've had a lot of spiritual experiences and spiritual awakenings. And I can have them at Vaughn's in the bakery section if you give me a chance to. And a lot of times I'll say to my girlfriends, "Hey, did you see that recovery movie the other night?" And I'll start describing it. And they'll say, "Denise, that was a Disney film. What the heck are you talking about?" But I want to tell you about a spiritual awakening that I had in the movie theater a few years ago. A whole group of us in the program went to see Guardians of the Galaxy 3. Don't worry, I'm not going to spoil the actual plot, but I'm going to tell you a little bit about what happened in that movie. So there was a warlord, right? And he was trying to create the perfect world, right? Where everybody's acting right. The actors are doing what they're supposed to do. He wanted the ballet to go off well. Is this sounding familiar to anyone? But what usually happens, the show wasn't going off very well. And so he's creating these worlds, and then when it doesn't work out very well, he's just destroying the world and starting over. Many of us have probably destroyed worlds that we had created. So at this point, he's already created and destroyed about three worlds, and he's about to destroy the fourth one. He's just pissed off. The creatures aren't creaturing right. The humans aren't loving him right. The sky isn't the right color. And he's about to destroy everything. And his right-hand lieutenant says, "For God's sakes." And the warlord said, "There is no God. That's why I had to step in." And a whole group of us are just sitting in this row in recovery, looking at the screen thinking, sounds like he needs a meeting. When you hear it that loud and booming, you can recognize the flaws in that idea. But I get that message frequently and quietly into my brain during the day. And for me, it often sounds like this. Did they really load the dishwasher like that again? I'm going to have to go over there and fix that. Or at work. She going to put those instruments in the sterilizer, or what is happening? Or occasionally at an AA meeting. Like, it is 2 minutes after. Who is in charge here, right? And sometimes these little thoughts by the end of the day can have me just completely wrapped around the axle. But the good news is enough of my friends have heard this story that I can be calling them, and I'll say, and then can you believe what she did? Then she told me, rah, rah, rah. And they'll say to me, for God's sakes, Denise. And right on cue, I'll respond, there is no God. That's why I had to step in. And then we laugh. And I completely forget what I was even mad about. I think it's important around here to have people that you can volley these concepts back and forth with. It's made a huge difference in my life, I've got to tell you. I've gone from homelessness to homeownership. And you know, that is not the most impressive part of this story. My home today is absolutely filled with recovery. The garage door is always open and the coffee is always on. We have people who come over to our house all the time just to sit and chat or to do step work or to read the book. And my beautiful boyfriend Gabe, a few years ago, with his own two hands, built me a shed in the backyard. I call it my she shed. And he put it up on the hill, up amongst the bushes. Because he wanted me to be comfortable up there. I'm going to tell you a little bit about my 16th sobriety birthday. I got sober at 30. I have 27 years sober. So this is something that happened, you know, about 10 or 11 years ago. But on my 16th sobriety birthday, I had a host of friends who showered me with gifts. And it happened to fall on a Monday that year. And on Mondays, I would normally meet with my sponsees. And so the sponsee that I was meeting with on that day happened to be on her fourth step. Now, she was on the fourth column of her fourth step. So what that means is she's already made a list of the people in the institutions and the principals that she had resentments towards. In the second column, she'd already written down a small explanation of the cause of the resentment. And in column three, she had already looked at the parts of self that had been affected by this resentment. Pride, self-esteem, ambition, personal relations, sexual relations, security, and fear. But now it was time for us to turn the page. And instead of looking at what they had done to us, it was now time for us to take a look at where we had been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and afraid. And I find whenever I get to this point in an inventory with a sponsee, I like to meet with them frequently because with each one of those columns, there really is a change of thinking that occurs. And sometimes with that change of thinking, you can open the door a little bit, but it'll slam back shut if you're not too careful. And so I find that sometimes they need help identifying where they had been selfish or an example of where they had been dishonest associated with this resentment. And so we're going through and we're coming up with these examples on this day. And all of a sudden you could just see the lights come on for my sponsee. And she gasped just a little bit as she uttered, oh my gosh, it was me the whole time. And we laughed and we cried and I could tell in that moment that her life had been changed forever. Don't miss it if you get the opportunity not only to take these steps, but to take other people through. Don't miss it if you get the opportunity. I felt so alive. The next day when I got home from work, there was a business card kind of oddly sticking out of my mailbox. And it was from an investigator at the medical examiner's office asking me to call them as soon as possible regarding Frank Paul Stone. And in that moment, I knew that he was dead. Paul had been my first husband. We'd been on the streets together. We got sober around the same time, and we had some great success in sobriety. But what happened was he had injured his back at about 5 years sober on the job and required surgery. And they gave him a fentanyl patch, and they prescribed him OxyContin. He started chewing the time-release OxyContins. And before I knew it, you know, boo-boo gone. You know, I woke up one morning and he was gone and just left, you know. And so at this time, we had been, you know, separated for about 8 years when I got this card from the medical examiner. And it just always kind of surprises me how two people can start out on this journey together and end up in such different places, with one person at that time celebrating 16 years of sobriety and the other person dead in a hotel room of an accidental overdose. But here, life takes on a new meaning. We watch people recover. We see them helping others. We watch loneliness vanish. We see a fellowship spring up around us, and we have a host of friends. We know you won't want to miss this. Page 89 of the Big Book. Thanks for letting me share.
Well, I'd like to thank Denise for being our speaker tonight. And hopefully you'll come back and visit us soon and be with us. I would also like to thank the residents of the house and the Women's Auxiliary for the dinner they served tonight. And we will now close in the usual manner if Denise will lead us out with a prayer of your choice.
Back.